Talks.com. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I have Jim Mascara. I mentioned that I've been doing this show on this channel before we changed formats for the last 3 years. Jim's been a recurring guest. He's a principal at Sentinel Consulting. It's www.sentinelconsulting.biz, B-I-Z, and Sentinel is S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L, sentinelconsulting.biz. It's a business restructuring and capital acquisition firm. He also operates the economic and financial website called The Sentinel, which is www.thesentinel.biz. He contributes financial and economic articles to various publications. He's been on this program before. Mr. Mascara is the author of two books. One's called Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. And recently he published Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. You can find more on that at www.escapingoz.com. Jim, welcome back to Your Money Talks.
Good morning, Jerry. Thanks again for having me on the show.
Hey, Jim, we got a lot in common in the fact that, I've got that industrial engineering degree myself. I don't have the master's in OR, operations research, but I know that you think about things from an engineer's point of view, how things work, and you've kind of applied that, if you will, to the real world of investing and the economy, and you've come up with some strategies out there that I think are very, very good, and you've put them in a couple of books. But first, if you could, what's the greatest problem facing our economy today?
Well, it's a four-letter word. It begins with the letter D as in dog and ends with the letter T, so it's debt, and debt on many levels. And one of the things that has probably been the most salient since the financial crisis, I guess, officially started in 2008 is the accumulation of debt, primarily at the public level. While private balance sheets have shrunk a little bit from a consumer perspective, the public purses have gotten much fatter. And there's also a debt component that's been created, if you will, by Federal Reserve action. So when you look at all that debt, and I mentioned this in the book at several points, there's only two things that can happen with debt in terms of it going away. It can either be retired through repayment or through default. And there's another more benign structure of default, which is restructuring. So until those things get cleared up, it's very, very difficult to have organic economic growth, which is really the end game for everyone, right? We want our economy to grow. But it's very difficult for that to happen when you have this constant overhang of debt.
Yeah, we want everybody to be Apple Computer, every company out there. That's what we're really looking for is growth. Companies like that, but we don't just need one. We need, thousands of companies like that. So when you say public, you mean like government debt, correct?
Yeah, debt at the government level, at federal level, at the state level, and some of that debt is what you would consider funded liabilities, and of course there's a very, very large component that dwarfs the funded liabilities, and those are the unfunded liabilities, which that's something that's a little bit less tangible. In my book, I reference the figure given by the former comptroller of the United States, David Walker, who in his book, I believe he published it sometime around, 2011, 2012, maybe before that, where he stated that the unfunded liabilities at that time were $63 trillion. I've seen, obviously, estimates greater than that. With the current interest rates that the economy is experiencing, unfunded liabilities are really a future projection of what the liabilities are going to be of the federal government, state governments, et cetera. Well, when you use the time value of money, when you're dealing with lower interest rates, you actually have to have more money available now to make up for the fact that you don't have these high interest rates that you'll need for greater sums required in the future. So because of that, I've seen estimates of those unfunded liabilities being over $100 trillion. So however you want to slice it, if you think it's $63 trillion, if you think it's $100 trillion, it's a number with a lot of zeros.
And an unfunded liability is something like our Social Security program, because basically back in, I don't know if it was the 70s or when it was, that they used that money basically in the general fund, and our general fund has actually got a deficit, so of whatever it is, current deficit of $17-18 trillion. So they took all that money that should have been in there and they spent that, right? And now we know what the liability is. We're just taking the money in from those people having their checks withheld, their some sums withheld from their checks every month or every pay period, and we're paying the people that are already out there. But it's an unfunded liability for everybody in the future that's paying into it. Is that what we're talking about here?
Right. There's that component, Jerry, but there's also the fact that, you know, it, pretend like you're doing your own personal financial planning, and you say that, you know, in the future, say if you want to retire 20 years from now, 30 years from now, you need X number of dollars. So that also tells you that you need to allocate money, save for that now, accumulate that over the future, anticipate some rate of return so you'll have that amount in the future. Well, you have two things. One, the way that the funding for Social Security has occurred, and I guess Medicare to a secondary degree, where those funds have been diverted, if you will, to general expenditures. But then you could also make the argument that perhaps even within those programs, the amounts that are being set aside, so the amounts that you see taxed on your wage slip, perhaps even aren't high enough, right? So you're saying two things. One, the money that you've supposedly allocated sits somewhere else, and two, perhaps you're not even allocating the amount of money that you should.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Jim Mascara. He's the author of Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. But we're talking about this, you know, the problem facing our economy, and he mentioned debt and government debt to some great degree. Now, Jim, we're talking the globe as well, because a lot of this isn't just a U.S. problem. We're talking about, you know, Japan has this problem with their aging population. We see Europe with the ECB, European Central Bank, about to embark on a quantitative easing program where they're just going to print trillions of dollars out in over the next, you know, year and a half, 2 years. This is a global issue, correct?
It's completely a global issue. There's strong demographic trends that are in place. You mentioned Japan. They're experiencing a demographic effect that has affected their deflationary environment that obviously has placed a lot of stress on their economy. They are going to have, obviously, a lot of unfunded liabilities. The United States is moving into that as well. I talk about that in the book, that some of the strong demographic trends that are present, in a lot of developed countries, are such that that's going to place more and more pressure on unfunded liabilities. And because we have these social covenants that we established many years ago, especially regarding, you know, retirement, the care, the medical care of elderly people, you know, now you have an expansion with the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, government has placed itself in a position to be the caretaker of the public, but it takes a lot of money to do that. And when you have demographics working against you, and again, it's not just the United States. I mean, you identified it. It's a much more broad problem. You're going to create some financial stress for yourself in the future.
So, Jim, you know, our listeners out there are going, well, okay, it's Valentine's Day, I got things to do. Sounds like a big problem down the road for somebody else. What does it mean? What's important about this to the market and investors today?
I think that probably what you're seeing today in the market is a lot of distortions. You were talking about earlier, I think I was hearing your comments about that price really conveys a lot of information, and it does. But I think that right now some of the prices that you see for certain things, and I'll just use financial assets as an example, probably aren't priced adequately. And, you know, when you talk about some of the future liabilities of, let's just use the United States government, well, those future liabilities, the funded liabilities, are marked by sales of Treasury bills, Treasury notes, Treasury bonds. As you know, the interest rates on those instruments has been trending down and perhaps has made a bottom here between 2012 and today. We have very, very low interest rates. And one of the things I point out in the book is that if you think about it, if you just think about it intellectually, when I first wrote Escaping Oz, the first Escaping Oz book, which was published 4 years ago, I showed what the liabilities were of the United States government. And now we have expanded liabilities, with our funded debt is now somewhere, I guess, $17-plus trillion. So it's substantially higher than it was before. The unfunded liabilities arguably are much greater, and yet the interest rates that people accept on U.S. government debt is very low. So, you know, a big component of any financial instrument is credit risk, right? So a point that I make in the book is if you go through this intellectual exercise and you say, is the United States a better credit risk today than it was 4 years ago, than it was, say, 10 years ago? So, because if you look at the interest rates that are being paid on those instruments, they're much lower. Use Japan as an example. Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio, what, 200, 250%? Mm-hmm. And yet you have a microscopic interest rate on their debt. So are they a better credit risk now than they were 4 years ago? I mean, I would just have a really hard time arguing that. And again, I realize these are governments and they have taxing power that individuals and corporations don't have. But I think that you have some unbelievably, probably historic distortions in the marketplace right now that you've never had.
Yeah, and I fully agree with you. I mean, that's, you know, one of the things I really like about your commentary, your books, and everything. I think you're spot on. But it seems to me, and again, that was kind of my point at Bryce's truth, is it seems to me that, you know, they don't care about today. As you know, look, like you talked about the Fed, you know, raising in the last 4 years between your first and second books, et cetera, the amount of money printed globally, let's say it's, you know, $10 trillion, and it's probably a number higher than that globally, and the economies grow by $8 trillion, and people say, wow, the economy's getting better, but really it's been a false sense of printing money that's really created this, and then there's some slippage because they're not getting a dollar-for-dollar return, right?
Yeah, you're not getting the same bang for the buck. You're creating more debt, so you basically created debt to paper over debt. And the central banker's greatest fear, you know, the wizards that I talk about in my book, is something they don't talk about too much in public, and that's deflation. You know, they want to have a certain amount of inflation built into their money schemes, if you will, their open market operations. I mean, that, and I won't get into, you know, what the reasons why the Fed existed in the first place, because there's a lot of debate about that. But, you know, they have a built-in target in the United States of a 2% inflation rate. So think about that for a second. The Fed wants 2% inflation. So if you take that over the course of time, they're telling you that it's okay if your currency is devalued by, you know, 2% or so every year. Now, to your point, there's been all of this injection into the economy by virtue of central bank action, again, not just the United States, but all over the world, and yet you have strong deflationary pressures in Japan. You're starting to see some significant deflation creeping in the European Union. And even within the United States, the Fed has this 2% inflation target rate. And probably for the last two or three years, we haven't been close to that. And think about how big the Fed balance sheet is. Now, there's some reasons why we haven't experienced the inflation that they wanted, but the fact remains is that their actions are not getting the desired results.
Right, yeah. They're not getting the results, and so that's why they keep printing more money, because kind of there's deflation, so they're trying to even just keep up with that, let alone create the inflation they want. Let's discuss the book. How is it structured? You know, give us a little background on that, please.
You know, I tried to keep the structure, you know, relatively similar to the first one. You know, I basically put it in three parts. You know, the first part is what I call the journey, and I talk about, you know, the origin of our problem. You know, how did we even get to this point? And I take it back a long ways, because at the end of the day, all of these problems stem from our unit of currency, our money. And I won't go into explanations here. You know, obviously, you know, I'd like people to read about that in the book. But the origin of our problem, you know, the base reason for our problem, the root cause, comes back to our money unit. And then from there, I talk about, you know, what's inflation, what's deflation. I really spend some time talking about human behavior, because any participant in the economy is a human, and they have emotions, and the way that finance has been taught, economics has been taught in this country, kind of goes along, you know, that classical finance model, which is, you know, everything's rational. And I even have this little image of Mr. Spock from the Star Trek series in there, because, you know, he's an eminently rational, logical being. But the reality is that people don't approach their investments that way. So I talk about, again, the journey of how we got here. Then I talk a little bit about the crisis. I spend a lot more time talking about the Federal Reserve, what I call the Supreme Wizard, in this book, where I didn't before. Spend a lot of time talking about what's kind of going on in the economy right now. And then the last part of it is what I call preparing our escape. again, talking a lot about investor psychology, you know, why people do the things that they do with their investments. I talk a little bit about banks, real estate, stocks, bonds, et cetera. I spend more time in this edition talking about retirement accounts, particularly those public retirement accounts at the state level. And then, you know, one of the things I do in this edition that I did in the last one is really, it's a chapter called What Do You Want Government to Be? And I know that sounds like a rhetorical question, but I think it's an important question that people really need to ask, because we've asked government to do a lot. And we know we have, because we have a large funded debt, and we have a very large unfunded debt as well, for the unfunded liabilities. So we've asked government to do a lot, but at the same time, we're probably not willing to pay for some of the things that government does. And government has kind of expanded its reach from an authority perspective. You know, the United States, for all intents and purposes, is an empire. We have troops in many countries overseas. So if you want to do all of those things, and you want to take care of people in old age, and you want to take care of their health, if you want to do all of that, it takes a lot more money, and it takes a lot more sacrifice than we as individuals have been willing to give. So my point in the chapter is, let's think about what we want government to really do, what did the founding fathers want government to do, and figure that out on a blueprint, and then say to ourselves, do we really want to pay for all that? If the answer is yes, then our taxes need to be much, much higher than they are, or we need to prioritize what we want to spend our money on.
Yeah, it's less of Democrats, Republicans, more of conceptual, what are we doing as a country, right?
Absolutely. And Jerry, I'm glad you brought that up, because never in any of my books do I mention one political party or another. This is not about a political party, about who's in office. To me, it's been almost irrelevant who's in office. It's really an introspection. Everybody needs to look in the mirror and say, okay, here's what we think government should do. Here's what the original plan was for government, and we've deviated from that. Is it important to do that? You know, it's like we had a very long discussion in this country about the Affordable Care Act, about what it was going to do, whether it was constitutional, and so forth. But if you think about it, we already had government well involved in health care in this country with Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, this was an expansion of something that we already had. So, again, one of the things I pose in the book is health care a right, like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? If you think it is, then understand that it's going to cost money to do that, and do you want to spend that money? And if you do, based on current budgets, maybe you can't spend it on something else. So, again, that's the kind of honest discussion I think that needs to happen about what you want government to be.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, I got that really good friend of mine, a university professor, and teaches, you know, several different classes, and he, you know, he always starts off, no matter what the class is, with the old, you know, the subject is, do you want equality or do you want freedom? Because if everyone's equal, you don't have freedom, and if everyone's free, you definitely won't have equality, because we're not all built the same. So you kind of, and you're just doing it from a governmental standpoint. Hey, Jim, I know we've gone a little over. Hopefully you got a little bit more time. I really enjoy this conversation. You got a couple more minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's keep
okay.
going.
All right, well, good. You know, the other big thing here is, you know, you wrote the first book, Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. Great timing on that. Now you've just come out with this second book, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. You know, a lot of people are wondering, I mean, did the economic crisis end, or are we still in it? And some people are saying, you know, I guess it depends on where you are in the, you know, with your job and things like that. Some people say, hey, look, the economy's improving, things are getting better, this crisis ended. And there's others out there who say, hey, no, that's Wall Street, not Main Street where I live. You know, we're still in the middle of it. What's your take?
Well, a couple of points. I talk about a topic that is really raised in the national consciousness probably in the last year or so by a French economist, Thomas Piketty, that has to do with wealth and income inequality. And I talk about that. And that's something that's going to get a lot of attention. And even in my first book, I talked about the intersection of politics and economics. And there's probably no better topic that'll get politics and economics clashing than wealth and income inequality. I mean, I would certainly hope that after some of the government deficits that we've run since 2007 and Federal Reserve actions, that things would be better. And certainly, from a statistical point of view, if you look at GDP numbers and so forth, yeah, things are better. However, if you look at, again, I'll go back to the wealth and income inequality, the gains, if you will, since 2007, 2008 have not accrued in the same proportion, if you will, to Main Street. And again, this goes back to my point about the fundamental causes of some of our problems. The origin of our problems is, you know, dating back to what we have as our money unit, you know, our ability to create credit, and particularly at the banking level and the Federal Reserve level. So I would say by many measures, things statistically are better, but there is, again, that overhang that I mentioned in the first part of our conversation, which is debt. And you can certainly make a lot of things look better with debt. If you had the ability to keep maxing out credit cards on a personal level, and you could do that for, you know, somewhat an indefinite period of time, all you're doing is rolling over debt. You're never really paying that off. So on the one hand, statistically, yeah, things look better. On the other hand, there's been debt. And let me mention one other thing I didn't mention before. We talked about debt at a public level. Companies have been acquiring a significant amount of debt because of low interest rates. You mentioned Apple Computer earlier. You know, Apple Computer is awash in cash, and yet they're still issuing bonds. So they're still borrowing money. So at some point, again, logically, intellectually, when interest rates reach a higher level, when that debt needs to be refinanced, it's going to be putting a lot of pressure on private companies that have issued debt. So I have some other statistics in the book that talk about the percentage of the workforce that's employed. That's been on a downward track since 2000. Having a bachelor's degree doesn't insulate you necessarily, because the percentage of people with bachelor's degrees that are in the workforce, that's been going down as well. So the percentage of people who have seen an increase in their participation in the workforce has actually been those 55 and over since the crisis started. And that kind of tells you something, that a lot of those people that may have thought about their retirement, their golden years, are having to participate in the workforce. So that should speak volumes there.
Yeah, they're pushing off retirement. So the point is, though, is that this debt, this is the real issue, is going to have to be dealt with in some way at some point in the future. And when it's dealt with, there could be some negative consequences, correct?
And that future is not necessarily that far away, because if you're a private company and you were raising capital through the debt markets, and that debt's 5 to 7 years long, at some point it's going to come due again. Are you going to pay it off, or are you going to roll it over? Probably you're going to try to roll it over. It's probably going to be at a higher interest rate, and hopefully that company's credit rating is the same as it was before. I think a lot of personal balance sheets, if you will, don't look, particularly those people that are close to retirement, don't look like what they anticipate. And I think a lot of people had inflation built into their own personal financial model, which is, I own a piece of property, and 20 years from now it's going to be worth this, and I can, you know, I'll have potentially more money available in my bank account, equity in my house, perhaps my stock portfolio, my bond portfolio, etc. And my contention is that I think those models probably are going to be altered adversely, and because of that, that's again part of this whole narrative of you don't have enough saved right now to deal with the future. So because of that, those are all basically very deflationary factors that will affect us in the future, because if there's less money, the value of things is less and there's not what you thought it was, you're not going to have that same purchasing power. And again, combine that with some of the demographic trends that I talk about in the book, and again, I think it speaks more to a very slow growth to a deflationary environment in the future.
Jim Mascara, principal at Sentinel Consulting. Jim, how do they follow you, and how do they get the book?
Sentinel Consulting, as you mentioned, is a business restructuring capital acquisition firm. You know, the one thing I do see in that part of the business is small businesses that, as a result of 2007, 2008, the banking industry experienced a sea change, and certainly in their underwriting practices. A lot of small businesses are not able to acquire the capital that they did before from commercial banking. And so one of the things I do is I try to help these small businesses find capital. And again, it's a different price capital. It's not going to be the same as going to commercial bank and getting those rates. So there's been kind of like a boutique industry that's evolved since then to fill that need where commercial banking is absent. And then the debt restructuring part of that business is I see many companies that are involved in litigation for breaches of contract, promissory note issues. Again, they owe money, so we try to help them with that. As you mentioned, the book site is escapingoz.com, and I actually have a contest on there right now with a giveaway via an organization called Goodreads that if you go to the site, you register, I'm giving away some copies of the book that will be randomly assigned, and I'll send a signed copy of the book to people. But there's other also information on the escapingoz.com website about, again, a little bit about the book. You can read a little bit, find out where you can buy it and so forth.
Yeah, www.escapingoz.com. Jim Mascara, Jim, hey, thanks for taking your time this Saturday morning here on Valentine's Day. I know you got things to do. I appreciate it. And, again, go to his website, buy his book, Escaping Oz, the new one, Navigating the Crisis. Thanks again for being with us here today on Your Money Talks.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
Yep. Again, Jim Mascara.